just say that the Reuters bureau chief worked tirelessly to get the collateral murder video and the military light. They said they didn't have it, they couldn't find it, and then we only saw it when Chelsea Manning very courageously gave it to WikiLeaks to publish. Until that time, the narrative that the military had spun out about that incident was a complete fiction. It was a lie.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges. Truth is the first casualty of war. In the old communist countries, comrades who fell out of favor with the party bosses were crudely cut out of photographs. Today, in the digital era, it's easy to electronically eliminate a person and/or their work. Take Chris Hedges. His show, On Contact, was aired on RT, a Russian state TV network. It was on YouTube when suddenly its six-year archive of programs disappeared. Hedges said this, "I vanished. In totalitarian systems, you exist, then you don't. I have a hard time seeing how a detailed discussion of Ulysses or the biographies of Susan Sontag and J. Robert Oppenheimer had any connection in the eyes of the most obtuse censors in Silicon Valley with Vladimir Putin." And then he warns, "If this happens to me, it can happen to you." Our guest today is Chris Hedges. He's an award-winning journalist who's reported from the Balkans, the Middle East, and Central America. Cornel West calls him the greatest radical writer and journalist of our generation. He writes a weekly column for Shearpost.com. He's the author of many books, including Death of the Liberal Class, Wages of Rebellion, and America, The Farewell Tour. I talked with him on March 28th. Welcome to the program. It's good to see you again.
Thanks for having me, David.
Well, a couple of bookend quotes I'd like you to talk about. Truth is the first casualty of war, which is attributed to Senator Hiram Johnson, and Randolph Bourne's War is the Health of the State.
In wartime, everything is sacrificed for the cause. The press and most of the public always falls in line in a conflict. Challenging the dominant narrative, even if you're speaking truth, is unacceptable. It will see you marginalized. It's certainly been true over the Ukraine conflict, but it's true in every conflict. And Bourne's statement that war is the health of the state means that in wartime, the state, with the excuse of national security, can accrue to itself all sorts of power that it wouldn't in peacetime be able to express. Censorship, control of resources, everything has to be sacrificed for the war effort, so you can't have strikes. And of course, Bourne was speaking about the First World War. Woodrow Wilson was the kind of best exemplar of this. He used the war, and remember, he had campaigned in 1916, I believe. His slogan was, he kept us out of the war. But once the war started, he passed the Sedition Act and the Espionage Act, which was used to shut down his left-wing critics like Eugene V. Debs, who he threw in prison. It was used later to deport Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman, and others. It was used to shut down the newspaper The Masses. None of this had really anything to do with a war effort. It had to do with crushing the left. That sets the template for what happens in a conflict. It is not just about hunting out people who might be sympathetic or working on behalf of those who are defined as the enemy. It's always used to crush the left.
Edwin Starr, in his 1970 hit song, you may remember it, was called War. And in that song, he asks, what is it good for? And he answers, absolutely nothing. But actually, for weapons manufacturers, it's a bonanza. In a talk that you gave at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, some months ago, which we aired on Alternative Radio, you mentioned seeing Raytheon billboards in Poland. Raytheon being a giant weapons manufacturer.
Right. Well, that is why NATO was expanded. I was in Eastern Europe in 1989 with the collapse of the Soviet Union as a reporter covering the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania. We naively thought that with the end of the Cold War, NATO had been rendered obsolete. It was a military alliance built specifically to prevent Soviet expansion into Eastern Europe. Everyone began talking about the peace dividend, so we wouldn't funnel staggering amounts of resources and state revenue towards the military, which of course had gotten insane even by the 1950s, where we were building nuclear weapons that it was no longer about what we could destroy in the Soviet Union, but it was geared towards productive capacity so that we could destroy the same Soviet city 20 times over. Those of us who were there turned out to be very naive. The arms industry had no intention of reducing its size or its grip on the state. It was universally understood that expanding NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany, and let's remember that Secretary of State James Baker in the Reagan administration, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, the German foreign minister, Margaret Thatcher, they all assured Gorbachev that NATO would not be expanded because it was geopolitically unnecessary. Gorbachev was actually looking for a kind of joint security alliance with Moscow, and it would be a provocation. And of course, it expanded anyway. And why did it expand? Well, because large corporations like Raytheon stood to gain tremendous amounts of money. Yes, I was in Warsaw a couple years ago, and there were Raytheon billboards all over the city because, of course, Raytheon is bilking the Poles. The Poles just signed a $6 billion deal to buy M1 Abrams tanks. And of course, we have seen now NATO alliances built with almost every country in Eastern and Central Europe, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Albania, Croatia, Montenegro, and North Macedonia. And it's a multi-billion dollar a year bonanza. And I think one of the legitimate complaints on the part of Russia is that the Ukraine is a de facto member of NATO, also supplied with tremendous, and of course this has all been augmented since the invasion and war, supplied with NATO compatible weapons and I think we had 150 military advisors in there. And one has to wonder if provoking Russia into a conflict wasn't part of the cynical plan on the part of the Western alliance, because, of course, stoking a war, which it's clear that Washington would like to turn into another Chechnya or the old Afghanistan. Remember, Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, began arming and supporting jihadists who were based in Pakistan to destabilize the government in Kabul, which was allied with the Soviet Union, baiting the Soviet forces into Afghanistan with the very costly war that ensued. And they clearly want the same thing in Ukraine. They in the parlance, they want Russia to bleed, but of course, it's really the Ukrainians who bleed. And that is the tragedy, that the peace was really sacrificed for U.S. global hegemony. It was sacrificed for billions in profits. The end of the Cold War should have seen us turn away from investing in arms and weapons and investing in people rather than systems of control to address the climate emergency. And of course, none of that is happening. And meanwhile, the greatest existential crisis to face the human species is taking place at an accelerated rate. The Amazon's reaching the tipping point, the land ice and ice shelves are melting at a far faster rate than climate scientists predicted, temperatures are soaring, monster hurricanes, floods, droughts, wildfires, crop yields are declining, and the collective folly of the ruling elites is propelling us once again towards permanent war.
Brzezinski was a notorious hawk who said he was going to set an Afghan trap, that's a direct quote, I think, to give the then Soviet Union its Vietnam. And it was fairly successful. The Soviets took the bait, as they may have taken the bait this time around as well.
There, you know, even Henry Kissinger, not someone I, you know, have any love for, understood that expanding NATO was going to push Russia. I mean, if you have you look at the history of Russia, especially going back to World War II, they were invaded by the Nazis. Much of the country was destroyed a century before Napoleon did the same thing. They have very legitimate security concerns. NATO has established a missile base in Poland that is 100 miles from the border with Russia. We almost had a nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union when they attempted to station missiles in Cuba, which is 90 miles from the coast of Florida. We can't excuse what Moscow did. Preemptive war under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression. However, they were clearly pushed and pushed and antagonized until, of course, they unfortunately pulled the trigger. But yes, this I think harkens back to the policy of Brzezinski and efforts to fuel the proxy wars that define the Cold War. I mean, and that's essentially what the Ukraine has become.
In Death of the Liberal Class, you quote Orwell's essay, Freedom of the Press, in which he says, at any given moment, there's an orthodoxy, a body of ideas, which it is assumed that all right-thinking people will accept without question. Anyone who challenges the prevailing orthodoxy finds himself silenced with surprising effectiveness. A genuinely unfashionable opinion is almost never given a fair hearing, either in the popular press or in the highbrow periodicals. Now, you've had some direct experience very recently with being silenced. Can you talk about your experience and what happened with your program on Contact on RTV, RT?
Right, so the entire archive of On Contact, which was nominated for an Emmy over the last 6 years, was disappeared from YouTube. Anyone who watched the program could, it'd be a big stretch to call it Russian propaganda. There was never any show on Russia, but it was really a book where I interviewed authors and intellectuals about their work. And it was a very wonky, serious show, the kind of show that would be on public broadcasting if we had a functioning public broadcasting system that wasn't beholden to wealthy donors and corporate elites for their funding. Some of the most recent shows were an interview with Nathaniel Philbrick on his book about George Washington. I did a show to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the publishing of James Joyce's Ulysses with Professor Sam Sloat from Trinity College Dublin. And then the kind of intellectuals who we should be hearing regularly from, who are not beholden to entrenched power, Cornel West, Noam Chomsky, Gerald Horn, Naomi Wolf, Slavoj Žižek, all of that's gone. So those are all, they've been disappeared by YouTube because, of course, it was propagated or put out by RT, American RT International. Well, why? Well, because I had nowhere else to go. You can put them out on sites, I suppose, where there's absolutely no pay. There's no ability, but, you know, in the end, we all have to pay a mortgage. We have to get something for our work. So we were people such as myself, Matt and Glenn are also in the same position. We've all gone to Substack. So I'm at chrishedges.substack.com, and it's subscriber-based. It's the only way left that we can continue to do our work. So I will go down to the real news and reconstitute my show. I will continue to write for Sheer Post every Monday. This is Bob Shear's column. And of course, we were all fired from Truthdig because we tried to form a union and because we were protesting the attempt by the wealthy publisher to fire Bob Scheer, the editor-in-chief, but Bob doesn't have any money. I mean, he runs this thing on a shoestring, basically from his Social Security check. So it's becoming harder and harder for those of us who care about journalistic independence and raising the voice of critics and dissidents and challenge this dominant effort, quite successful effort on the part of the established media to render whole sections of the country, and in particular the poor and the working class, invisible. And I think that's, over the long, my long career, quite distressing, that when I began, and I worked for the New York Times for 15 years, there was a place for journalists such as myself. We may have clashed with the newsroom hierarchy. I'm sure we were considered management headaches, but we were there, people like Sidney Shanberg and others. And now that space is gone. And so what happened with RT was really a reaction, not to RT. They've long waited to shut RT down, and they were quite explicit in the 2017 Director of National Intelligence report about why. There are 7 pages in that report dedicated to RT, and they complain about Russian propaganda, but all of the examples they cite are about giving voice, in their words, to third-party candidates, to Black Lives Matter activists, to Occupy activists, anti-fracking activists, anti-imperialists. That's they tipped their hand. They showed what it was that enraged them, and the invasion of the Ukraine gave them the opportunity to do what they have long wanted to do. And now, of course, you're seeing calls to shut down Substack. I think one of the most disturbing realities for me is the way the Democratic Party and the liberal class has signed on for this censorship. We saw the amazing spectacle of Democratic Congress members calling in the CEOs of Facebook and other major digital platforms and asking them to do more to censor content. And that gets into the question why. And I think the reason is because the ruling establishment, which includes the Democratic Party and the old establishment wing of the Republican Party, is not accepting responsibility for the distortions of neoliberalism and austerity and deindustrialization, which have given rise to these, I'm frightened of them too, these QAnon conspiracy theorists and Christian fascists, who I wrote about, by the way, in a book called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America, these gun-toting militias, the cult-like Republican Party that's now been built around Trump. And so rather than dealing with the endemic social distortions or endemic social inequities that have given rise to the most rapacious oligarchic class in American history, they're attempting to silence critics, people who I would argue are speaking the truth about the system, and they're hoping that that will make it all go away. It's very much like 1932 in Germany. You have the old establishment coalesced around von Papen taking power, desperately trying to bring back the ancien regime to stave off the Nazis, when in fact what they do by not responding to the very real distress of the German population in Weimar, where to service bank loans they actually cut unemployment insurance, made sure or ensured the rise of fascism. And I think we're seeing the same thing with the Biden administration. You know, every promise that Biden made, the $15 minimum wage, forgiving student loans, his Build Back Better America bill, which has been gutted, which they won't even mention now, the moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions being lifted, the cutting of the supplemental income child tax credits, supplements to unemployment. It's a very similar process whereby that myopia or inability to grasp the political, economic, and social reality sees them going after the people who call it out. And that's why they did what they did.
And YouTube, which disappeared your On Contact archive, is owned by the tech giant Google. I think somewhere you mentioned that the last really critical program on public TV was Bill Moyers, when he went off the air in 2015, and there hasn't been anything comparable since.
Yeah, and it's interesting that in the end, Moyers was not funded by PBS. He got, I think it was the Schumann Foundation, or a foundation actually funded his show. Even PBS wouldn't fund it. And it was reduced to a half hour. So you already saw that shrinking space. And then once Moyers was gone, I think that was the last serious exploration of power on public broadcasting. He was not replaced. There's nothing that took his place.
And you also quote, I'll quote again, George Orwell on, if liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they don't want to hear. It is the liberals who fear liberty and the intellectuals who want to do dirt on the intellect. Now, you've focused for many years on the betrayal of the liberal class. What is it that they fear, if Orwell is spot on, that liberals fear liberty?
Well, yes, Orwell is spot on. And that's why Orwell, in homage to Catalonia, took on the propagandists for the Republicans like Gellhorn and Hemingway and others, where he included that chapter on the Barcelona uprising by the anarchists that was ruthlessly suppressed. He himself had been fighting in the PUM. He actually, in fact, had been shot through the neck. So, well, what are liberals? I think we owe a great debt to Noam Chomsky, who has, I think, explained for us, perhaps better than anyone, how the liberal class works. So the liberal class posits itself, I'm stealing all this from Noam, as the kind of moral center, the moral arbiter of society. And it doesn't want that position assailed in any way. And the quid pro quo with the ruling elite is that they will critique the excesses of a capitalist democracy, of its militarism, et cetera, but never critique the virtues, never critique the motives. And as soon as you begin to examine or critique the motives of the ruling elite, then you are cast out of the liberal class. What's interesting is that the attack dogs that are used to discredit you are the liberals. And I will give my own personal experience. My decision to stand up and denounce the call by the Bush administration to invade Iraq saw me excoriated, not by the right. I was excoriated by the right, actually. I was on Rush Limbaugh, I was a punching bag on all this stuff. But the most effective way to discredit me came from liberals, George Packer, Michael Ignatieff, David Remnick, all these figures who supported the war in the name of humanitarian intervention. And that becomes a very effective technique. Look at Gary Webb, the guy who broke, the investigative journalist who broke the story on the San Jose Mercury News, who broke the story on the collaboration between the CIA and drug dealers shipping cocaine to the United States, taking cash and taking it back to Central America to fund the Contra rebels that were fighting the Sandinistas. How was he taken down? He was taken down by the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, all of the mainstream media. I've gone back and read those stories. I actually know the reporters who wrote them. And all they got were briefings from the CIA. They never actually went out and investigated themselves the facts or the evidence that Webb had uncovered. And he was destroyed. I think he committed suicide finally, right? But he certainly had no work in the end. And that's a classic example of how the liberal elites are used and why they're allowed to exist. So yes, Orwell's spot on, and you see it now. Well, you saw it under the whole ridiculous Russiagate stuff, where the idea that Trump was elected by Russia is absurd. But the liberals suddenly became the best friends with the FBI and everyone else. I mean, Mueller became an icon in the liberal establishment. You see it now, this kind of warmongering on the part of liberals over Ukraine without any kind of real understanding of the conflict, or I would argue the consequences of this. So this is the traditional role of the liberal elites, and it's why people like Noam and I hate them so much.
Let's talk about National Public Radio for a moment. You filed for them during the 1980s from Central America. In a recent 9-minute interview with Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of State, She was never asked about the sovereignty of Afghanistan and Iraq when those two countries were invaded, when she was NSA advisor, National Security Advisor, and later Secretary of State. So the question is, the questions not asked, what is embedded and assumed as proper? And the NPR reporter, during its 9 minutes, never had the temerity or the courage or the insight to ask Rice, hey, you know, what about these previous violations of the UN Charter and international law and violations of countries' sovereignties like Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, yeah, because of course the reporter wouldn't keep their job. I remember on the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, there was this fawning half-hour interview with Rumsfeld on NPR. I worked for NPR. I covered the Falkland War from Buenos Aires for NPR. NPR began as a very different organization, a very scrappy, independent, almost rebellious, and then was co-opted and became essentially no different from the commercial press. In fact, of course, it runs commercials like PBS. They don't call it commercials. They call it sponsorship. They, as you saw, withdrawal of government funding, they leaned more and more on the very centers of financial power that they should be critiquing. I can hardly listen to NPR anymore. And of course, they fill their quote-unquote news segment with fluff, with lifestyle stuff and interviews with country Western stars and to try and cater to a broad demographic. Now, all of that stuff, I'm not against it. I actually even did reporting like that, but not on the news hour. It's not news. So there's been a terrible corruption within public broadcasting. And that, of course, is part of the problem, because public broadcasting is where you should be able to go to hear independent voices. And if you go back to the 1970s, you saw Noam Chomsky or Howard Zinn or even Malcolm X, Angela Davis, James Baldwin, all of these very important figures were given a platform on public broadcasting, but that's gone, that's finished. And that's part of the whole calcification or the atrophy of the press within the United States that has really taken place over my own lifetime as a journalist.
You're listening to Chris Hedges, Truth is the First Casualty of War. This is Independent Alternative Radio. Ralph Nader has talked about how he too has been marginalized and has had to do his own program now. He told me he's getting very few invitations to speak around the country.
Well, they went after Ralph in the 1971 Lewis Powell memo, which was the blueprint for corporate control, pushback against the popular movements, what Samuel Huntington called our excess of democracy. They named Ralph. Ralph was in that document. He was named in that document because, of course, he had built very powerful consumer movements. I think there are 24 bills, the Mine and Safety Act, OSHA, all this kind of stuff that Ralph actually wrote and then got put into law with the old liberal wing of the Democratic Party before it was destroyed largely by Clinton. So self-identified liberals now have no relationship, this is part of my book, Death of the Liberal Class, with the actual liberal establishment. They're liberal on cultural or social issues, but are in lockstep with the rest of the ruling elite on issues of war and trade deals and austerity and deindustrialization and everything else. So yes, Ralph has been marginalized, I would argue largely blacklisted, because he was targeted and because they're frightened of him. And that's, of course, why he ran for president, that we couldn't get anything done anymore in Congress, with the destruction of that real liberal wing, he had nowhere else to go. And I worked as Ralph's speechwriter. Ralph's argument was that if we can pull 5, 10, 15 million people into a third party, that's the only mechanism we have left to put pressure on the Democratic Party. But of course, the Democrats made war on Ralph, kept him out of the debates. I guess I got some sympathy with that. I wouldn't want to debate Ralph Nader. Challenged his voting lists, even though they were all they were unimpeachable because they wanted to run up his legal bills, and then blamed him for electing Bush, which is a complete distortion of that historical moment, because they only counted two counties in Florida, immediately moved it to the Supreme Court, where Bush, defying any legal precedent, was anointed president. It was kind of judicial fiat. I think even Al Gore says he won. That is a classic example of how the liberal establishment is used to demonize, discredit, and marginalize those figures with integrity to challenge the dominant narrative. I just came back from London. I was invited, one of six guests, at Julian Assange's wedding. And then, of course, when I and Craig Murray and others got there, the prison authorities just capriciously, unilaterally, and without explanation, refused to let us in. It was just another cruel act, even on Julian's wedding day. Another example of somebody who has been discredited largely by the very liberal press establishments that publish the material that he gave them through the Iraqi war logs and all this kind of stuff.
You said in an article you wrote, "I like and admire Julian. He provided the most important body of information of our generation about the war crimes, lies, corruption, and cynicism that defines the ruling elites. This information ripped back the veil on the centers of power around the globe, sparking movements and popular protests from Tunisia to Haiti." Why are they so persistently hostile and aggressive vis-a-vis Julian Assange, who's a 50-year-old, you know, independent journalist who founded WikiLeaks? He's from Australia. He's not even an American citizen, yet he's being charged under American law. How does that work?
Well, it's judicial farce. I've sat through some of the court proceedings in London, and it's like something out of Alice in Wonderland. I mean, we have to remember that UC Global, the Spanish security firm in the embassy, recorded all of Julian's meetings with his attorneys and turned them over to the CIA, violating attorney-client privilege. I mean, that fact alone should see the trial tossed out. The idea that Julian, who's not an American citizen, WikiLeaks is not a U.S.-based publication, can somehow be charged under the Espionage Act, that's a real kind of leap there legally. Well, why? Because he's the most important publisher of our generation. He shone a light into the inner workings of power in a way that we got pieces here and there before, but no one had come close to doing what he did. He documented U.S. war crimes, including, of course, the video of the collateral murder video. He exposed that nearly 700 civilians had been gunned down for approaching too close to U.S. checkpoints. He exposed the hacking tools known as Vault 7 by the CIA that gives the CIA the ability to compromise cars, smart TVs, web browsers, operating systems of smartphones, systems such as Microsoft Windows, etc. He exposed the 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, the torture of 800 men and boys between ages 14 and 89 at Guantanamo. He published the Podesta emails, which exposed the mendacity of Hillary Clinton, including ordering U.S. diplomats to spy on the U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, along with the U.N. representatives from China, France, Russia, and the U.K. And this included their DNA, iris scans, fingerprints, personal passwords. He exposed the complicity of Clinton as Secretary of State and Barack Obama and the CIA in overthrowing the elected president, Manuel Zelaya, our complicity in the war in Yemen, the $657,000 paid to Hillary Clinton to give three talks at Goldman Sachs, a sum so large it can only be considered a bribe, the effort by...
And they sidelined Bernie Sanders.
Well, the effort to destroy Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn in the Labor Party. So, you know, that he kind of ripped the curtain back. And for that, he will never be forgiven. And of course, they're destroying him physically and psychologically. He's in a high security prison, very notorious prison, Belmarsh, outside of London, southeast London. He's not, unfortunately, in very good condition. It came out in the trial that I covered that he was observed frantically pacing his cell, punching himself in the face, banging his head against the wall, calling the Samaritan hotline because he was, quote unquote, thinking about committing suicide 100 times a day, hallucinating. They're shipping him off to the medical wing. They found a razor under his socks, and then he had a stroke in the middle of his hearing in October. We know he's on antidepressants, anti-stroke medication, anti-psychotic drugs. He's gaunt, his posture is poor, his color is ashen, and that's really the plan. The plan is to psychologically and perhaps physically obliterate him as an example. They need to crucify Julian as a kind of warning to anyone else who might try and expose or shine a light on the inner workings of power. That's why they're so ruthless against him.
That video that he made available, the collateral murder, it had the Apache helicopter pilots chortling as they were shooting up the unarmed Iraqis, including, I believe, two Reuters employees.
Yes, who were both killed. Just say that the Reuters bureau chief worked tirelessly to get that video and the military lied. They said they didn't have it, they couldn't find it, and then we only saw it when Chelsea Manning very courageously gave it to WikiLeaks to publish. Until that time, the narrative that the military had spun out about that incident was a complete fiction. It was a lie.
Now, other than you and John Pilger and a handful of others, have any of the major journalists of this era, you know, like David Brooks and Thomas Friedman and Jonathan Capehart and others, have they come to Julian's defense at all? Have they written anything in support of his case?
Not that I know of. And again, these people are careerists. They were cheerleaders for the Iraq War, not because they knew anything about the Middle East. Well, Friedman was actually stationed in the Middle East, but because they knew what was good for their own advancement. They were wrong. Everything they wrote about invading and occupying Iraq was wrong, but they're still where they are because they are courtiers. That's what they do. And Julian is a toxic subject, especially after the release of Vault 7. And they are, if nothing else, they're very astute about how to promote themselves. They're not going to touch Julian.
Well, the whole persecution and prosecution of Julian Assange and other whistleblowers. Let's not forget, you mentioned Chelsea Manning, John Kiriakou, Edward Snowden remains in exile and is, you know, probably going to come under more pressure as time evolves. Do you know anything about Snowden's case? I mean, he is in Russia, right?
Yes, he's in Russia because
John Kerry took away his passport.
They took away his passport. He was in transit to Ecuador, and he got trapped in the airport. He had no passport, and so he was given asylum by Russia. He didn't go to Russia for asylum. He's now in a very difficult position. I think that if the goal of these sanctions, by the way, is clearly to remove Putin, and if they are able to install a pliant Russian regime such as Yeltsin. Yeltsin did the bidding of Wall Street and Washington, which is why when he ran for re-election in 1996, the Clinton administration got him, I think it was an $11 or $10 billion IMF loan, of which an estimated $1.5 billion was used to re-elect Yeltsin. If they get a pliant regime back there, by the way, I just bring that up when you talk about meddling. Nothing Russia or China or any country has done here comes close to what we have done overseas, and in particular with the Yeltsin re-election. But if they get a pliant regime in Moscow, they will demand Snowden's extradition, without question.
Talk about the sanctions as a weapon of war. Cuba, for decades now, 50, 60 years, has been subjected to sanctions. Iran, Venezuela, Syria, Afghanistan, and of course now Russia. Who is hurt by sanctions?
Well, we know who's hurt by sanctions. It's always the ordinary people because the elites have the power and the resources to make sure that they are cushioned from the effects of sanctions. So yes, there always, we began by talking about what happened to Iraqi children, but that is part of the cynical game. So you destroy the sustainability of life in a country, and then the goal is that they put pressure or you build enough pressure to overthrow the regime. We've tried this in Iran for years and years. It hasn't worked. We've tried it for decades after decade in Cuba. It hasn't worked. And so even though it's not usually a very effective technique, it's employed. And unfortunately, the cost is paid by the most vulnerable.
Talk about the courage of a Russian TV employee, Channel One, Marina Ovsyannikova. She went on a live broadcast and stood behind the anchor holding up a sign, "They're lying to you." She later said, "I wanted to show the Russians that they were zombified by the Kremlin propaganda and that they should stop believing it." Can you close your eyes for a moment and imagine, let's say, Martha Raddatz, who's the ABC TV foreign correspondent, standing behind David Muir on ABC World News Tonight, holding up a sign saying, you know, "They're lying to you"?
I can't imagine that because these people are well-conditioned and well-trained to serve the centers of power. That was a very courageous moment, but I think we also have to pay homage to dissident journalists who have long, she had worked for, of course, Russian state media, but there were a series of news organizations that defied Putin's censorship over the years and paid a very heavy price for it, a few of whom were killed, and they were all shut down. So that single act of defiance was certainly courageous, but I don't want us to lose sight of those real journalists who had for years pushed back against the Putin regime, and now, of course, have been essentially banished from the media landscape.
Talking about West Asia and specifically the ongoing situation with the Palestinians, Israel was accused by Amnesty International in a report that it was essentially an apartheid state. This story ran on page 12 of the New York Times, and there was a subheadline, "Israeli officials denounce the claims made by Amnesty." You've been a supporter of the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanction movement. Do you think it's been effective?
Yes, not because institutions or universities have actually disinvested funds in Israeli companies, but in terms of raising consciousness, very effective. And that's why Israel has really mounted war against it, including getting state legislatures to pass legislation that criminalizes support for BDS. Israel has lost control of the narrative. They have been exposed not only as an apartheid state, but as an occupier who uses disproportionate military power. I think that reality now is no longer hidden, especially to a younger generation and young American Jews who no longer have that emotional attachment to Israel that perhaps their parents or their grandparents had. I mean, I always try and meet with Students for Justice in Palestine groups when I'm at universities, and I would say a significant percentage, a third, sometimes more, of those students are Jewish. And this, of course, is deeply disturbing to Israel, that is responding in a very similar way to the way the ruling elites are responding in the United States, and that is to essentially shut down those organizations that amplify the truth about what's happening rather than curb or change their behavior. And it's why, of course, Israel is building an alliance with the Christian right, I would call them the Christian fascists, who, by the way, are very anti-Semitic. I mean, this is kind of the irony of it, because they don't have any popular support, and why they're pushing through this kind of legislation to criminalize anybody who supports BDS. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, your criminal activity because you won't buy an Israeli product. So I think it is effective, not in perhaps the way it was designed, but it's effective as a tool for education, for allowing people to understand the reality of Israeli occupation.
Now, there is such a thing, a horrible thing, as anti-Semitism. And then there is also the legitimate criticism of a particular state and its policies. How do you separate those two?
Well, attacking a state is not the same thing as attacking somebody for being Jewish or even attacking the Jewish religion. But of course, what Israel has done quite effectively is equate any criticism of the state of Israel and its ruling ideology, Zionism, as anti-Semitic. In fact, of course, I think that they have done a great disservice to those of us who are anti-racist, because it's fed the narrative of radical anti-Semitic right-wing groups. And that inability to make a distinction, I think, has had a kind of boomerang. I think it's been counterproductive to Israel, but it's been an effective technique to silence critics of the Israeli state, of course, many of whom are Jewish. I mean, and then they've got a term for that, self-hating Jew. I'm sure they've thrown that at Noam and others. That's a distinction that the Israeli government doesn't make, but I believe they should make.
The late Howard Zinn was a critic, Amy Goodman, right. Richard Falk, Norman Finkelstein. There are many American Jews who are critical of Israeli state policy. Well, where do you see that going? I mean, how is that issue going to be resolved? Are the Palestinians in this perpetual chokehold with no way out?
Yeah, because they have no power. Nobody will stand up. They're powerless. And because of that, even countries in the Middle East, they may pay lip service to Palestinian rights, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, but they don't do anything because the Palestinians themselves they can't project power outwards. And that's, of course, what's been trapped. I think the only mechanism we have left is the BDS movement. It's really modeled on the divestment movement against the apartheid regime in South Africa. And it's also nonviolent. And that's why I'm a very strong supporter of BDS. I think if we can build that kind of movement, that's probably the best mechanism we have to put pressure. And it's clear that the Israeli government is quite frightened of it. We have reports that they have a whole office set up that they're funding quite lavishly to counter the BDS movement, which has been effective in the United States, but extremely effective in Europe.
One aspect of the issue is the Syrian Golan Heights, which has been annexed formally into the state boundaries of Israel. There's very little commentary about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the violation of international law, which is, expansion of Israel, East Jerusalem, which is occupied territory. Of course, the settlements themselves, the Israeli government keeps threatening to make them part of Israel, but they are a de facto, in a kind of way, incorporated into the Israeli state. So Israel, since its inception in 1948, has carried out a kind of administrative, they carried out a very physical and brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing. It's how people ended up in Lebanon, Gaza, and Jordan, Palestinians. But there's been a kind of ongoing administrative ethnic cleansing and seizing of territory. Ilan Pape wrote quite a good book about this. We uncovered some fascinating documents. Even I, who had covered the Middle East and been there 7 years, didn't grasp how old that plan was, predating the 1967 war. Long been the plan of Israel to essentially crush Palestinian rights, to make life as a Palestinian so difficult that they would be forced to leave the country. That's long been a plan, going, almost back to the inception of the Israeli state.
I think it was Moshe Dayan, the legendary Israeli general and war hero, who said of the Palestinians, they can live like dogs or they can leave.
Yeah, well, that really is probably the good summation of Israel's policy towards the Palestinians. And we cannot underestimate the horror of life in Gaza, the world's largest open-air prison. Clean drinking water is almost impossible to come by. People are crowded, 10, 15 people into a room. they call it mowing the lawn, routinely attacked with heavy weapons, including, I've been in Gaza when the Israeli Air Force has bombed refugee camps, and you hear the announcement out of Jerusalem, and they're talking about surgical strikes against bomb-making factories, and I'm physically there, and the entire block is gone, and I'm looking at the bodies of children. So this is Israeli policy. It's a campaign of ongoing terror, and as a way to essentially reduce the Palestinian population and expand Israeli hegemony.
What sources do you turn to for information?
Well, like any news junkie, I consume a lot of sources. I do read the New York Times. I listen to BBC NewsHour pretty much every day. I like Amy Goodman. I read a series of sites, including Aretz, by the way, the Israeli newspaper, which I think has some of the best coverage of the Palestinians. I read foreign press like Le Monde. I look at sites, Counterpunch, and I look for like any journalist, I often look for writers themselves. I was great friends with Robert Fisk, who did wonderful coverage on the Middle East. I really didn't care where Fisk's story was published. I would read it. So oftentimes I look for journalists whose reporting I trust.
2022 is the centenary of Howard Zinn's birth. You use his classic book, A People's History of the United States, in your classes with prisoners. What is it about Zinn's work that is so exemplary and that inspires you to use his book?
Well, it was interesting. So I was teaching mostly Black men in a prison. And I always admired Zinn, of course. But teaching the class drove home to me that these men had never been taught their own history. Zinn is very cognizant of the African-American experience from the beginning of the book till the end. And I would be giving these 90-minute talks on whatever section of the book we were reading, and I would hear students go, damn, we've been lied to. And of course they had been lied to. And they were just enthralled. They couldn't get enough. And I used Anthony Arnold's and Zinn's companion book, which had original documents. So it had Sojourner Truth's Ain't I Woman and Frederick Douglass's 4th of July speech. And I would have students come up and read the original text before the class began. And I remember, I think it was with Sojourner Truth, I went to collect it. And the student who read it, can I take it back and put it on the wall of my cell? So I came away from that class with a much deeper understanding and appreciation for Zinn as a historian, because he was telling stories that meant something, stories that ruling academics who couldn't wait to write another biography about Teddy Roosevelt don't tell. And also Zinn understood that the real advances within the United States came through movements, that the inception of the country, which was set up by white male aristocratic, largely slave holders, was meant to thwart popular democracy, and that's quite clear in the Federalist Papers. All the people that were disenfranchised, women, Native Americans, African Americans, men without property, it was a battle for them to find their place within American society, and American society was very violent in terms of suppressing that struggle for justice. We had the bloodiest labor wars of any country in the industrialized world. Hundreds of American workers were murdered. Tens of thousands were blacklisted. Of course, we know the history of the reign of terror that continues to this day against African Americans. And it was the courage of those movements, the abolitionist movement, the suffragists, the civil rights movement, the labor movement, that created a more inclusive country. And Zinn grasped that point. And that's an extremely important point. And that's why Zinn kept warning us correctly, stop talking about elections. Elections are fine, but without popular movements, you get nowhere. It's the great Emma Goldman quote, if elections were that effective, they'd be illegal. And they want to reduce our political participation to going off and voting for one corporate-controlled Democrat who's campaigning against another corporate-controlled Republican.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, David.
You were just listening to Chris Hedges, Truth is the First Casualty of War. I talked with him on March 28th. Chris Hedges is an award-winning journalist who's reported from the Balkans, the Middle East, and Central America. He writes a weekly column for Sheer Post. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent nonprofit and in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Noam Chomsky, Vandana Shiva, Angela Davis, and Ralph Nader. And we have a series of programs with Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Our theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.